Center for Inclusive Childcare welcomes you to Inclusion Matters. We share resources and information to support quality childcare for all children. By partnering with early childhood professionals, parents, grandparents, and other caregivers, we work together to help every young child thrive. Welcome to Inclusion Matters, a podcast from the Center for Inclusive Childcare. I'm Priscilla Weigel, the Executive Director, and I'm grateful today to have a guest back that we had on the show a while ago, and she's here today to join us to update some things and information for our listeners. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Jennifer Hall Landy. Welcome, Jen.
Happy to be here.
It's great to have you back, and I'm going to just tell our listeners a little bit about what you do and how you spend your time, because I think it's quite impressive. So I want them to know about you. Dr. Jennifer Hall Landy is a licensed psychologist and researcher at the University of Minnesota's Institute on Community Integration and Masonic Institute on the Developing Brain. Her work focuses on autism, developmental delays, early identification, early intervention, and building systems that support children and families. Dr. Hall Landy leads Minnesota's autism surveillance efforts through the CDC-funded Minnesota Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, and also conducts clinical developmental and autism evaluations. Her unique perspective bridges public health research, clinical practice, and inclusive community supports. So welcome, Jen. I'm excited about our conversation today to really help our listeners understand a little bit about how those autism numbers kind of come to be and how Minnesota looks in the realm of nationally. So why don't we just jump right in and ask you to tell us a little bit about where we sit in Minnesota currently related to autism.
Great. Well, thank you, Priscilla. I'm really happy to be back. It's great to see you, and it's great to be here with your listeners. And I'm excited to talk about Minnesota autism prevalence numbers today. It's one of my favorite topics. Before I start, and again, I will be sharing a lot of numbers today, I do want to say that while numbers are important and data is important, I'm well aware that when we talk about numbers, every number we talk about represents a child and a family and a community, all working together to try and provide the best possible services and supports for the best possible outcomes. So again, I'm going to talk about numbers, but I'm going to try and link it into stories and experiences and hopefully keep it interesting as well. So you asked, how does Minnesota look? And also, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the national numbers as well. Yes. And if you don't mind, I may share a little bit of history, autism history, that I think is interesting.
Yes, please do. So
last year, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is the funder of this project, both nationally and in Minnesota, released their most recent autism prevalence numbers. What we saw were autism prevalence rates across U.S. communities were about 1 in 31. We really look at 8-year-old children. We look at a variety of ages. But today I'm going to talk about 8-year-olds because that's really our primary group. You know, fun fact, the CDC has been collecting data on autism since the year 2000. So 26 years of autism prevalence data and trends that have really shaped our understanding of autism in the United States and also has contributed a lot to the autism research literature base. And I'm going to talk about that today. But your question might be, how does Minnesota compare to that national number of 1 in 31? What our data told us was about 1 in 28 children in Minnesota communities are identified with autism. That, you know, statistically speaking, that's relatively consistent with the national number. So we're kind of, you know, really right in the middle of all of the autism ATOM sites. And I need to be careful of acronyms. I'll probably shorthand it to ATOM, but what ATOM stands for, and you said in your intro, it stands for Autism Developmental Disability Monitoring Network. We count the number of children with autism in communities, but we also report on really important trends such as age of identification, Where we're telling you who were identified, what it looks like between boys and girls, you know, where they're identified. Are they identified in schools or clinics? When? What age? You know, we know very clearly, and I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir with your audience, but the earlier we identify a child and get to them with effective services and supports, the better their life outcomes. Yeah. And so that is a trend we monitor. And we really are always trying to move the needle on that number to identify children younger and get them the services and supports they need as young as possible.
That's exciting to know. And all of the, and I do think our listeners are truly always on the alert to really notice things in a child's developmental path. And so you've got a lot of allies in the listening audience here to be helping you do the work that you're doing. So when we think about increasing rates, what does the research tell us about those rates increasing?
Yep. It's a great question. It's a question I get a lot when I share the data. And I think it is an important question. I'm going to back up just a little. You know, when we look at those national numbers again, we look back at that study year 2000, 26 years ago. The world was different then, right? And, and so were autism numbers. We were seeing rates of about 1 in 150 at that time. So again, if we look at the most recent numbers, about 1 in 31, we have seen a steady increase. That is real. If we look at it statistically, that's about a fivefold increase in the past 26 years. But so a lot of people, it's natural to ask why. And I'm going to tell you, there's not one single answer, but I'm going to tell you some of the reasons why. And again, it's going to be a little bit of a walk back historically. There's many structural and policy reasons that we are aware of that contribute. And again, not one single answer, but I'm going to give you several different likely contributing factors. So one of them is policy and structural changes, such as in the year 2007, the American Academy of Pediatrics issued a recommendation saying that all children should be screened at 18 and 24 months with an autism-specific screener. So we have a smart audience, right? Common sense would tell us the more children we screen, the more we'll refer, and the more we'll move on to autism assessment and be identified. So that is one ingredient of many. We also look, there have been a lot of public health campaigns in the last 10 years, such as Learn the Signs Act Early that I also work on, that really works on creating awareness around healthy development, developmental milestones, and acting early if there are concerns. So really, we're much more aware of autism than we used to be. At this point, I've been practicing for a while as a psychologist. And, you know, I notice a trend shift since when I started off early with young families. When I started off about 20 years ago, it wasn't common for families to come to me with a young child with concerns with autism. Now, it's quite common. Parents are aware. They want to get help and services. And really, we've seen just, you know, a shift in how we do it in many ways, which is good. We really, as a society, have accepted neurodiversity. And really, many parents want to get their children the help as early as possible. Another important one that got a lot of attention, if we can think back to 2013, when we had a shift in the diagnostic criteria. It may sound like I'm kind of in the weeds here, but it was important. In 2013, we changed what we call the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM. That's for psychologists like myself. That is the tool we use to diagnose. And when we moved from DSM-4 to DSM-5, we went away from some of those separate categories. You might remember Asperger's syndrome. Other categories such as pervasive developmental disorder, PDD-NOS, those shifted to a different way of viewing autism as more of a spectrum. It's in the name, right? When we say autism spectrum disorder. So what we've seen is a shift in terms of who are identifying with autism. And what we know from the research is the majority of children that we are bringing in under that autism diagnosis have an average to above average IQ. It used to be, prior to that, autism and intellectual disability were sort of seen as synonymous. So we're bringing in a lot more children that have higher verbal abilities, higher intellectual abilities. And so the population has shifted and trends have shifted. And so again, that's another contributing factor that we're seeing to structurally and policy-wise why we are seeing more children. But people always say, no, I want to know more. Well, what else has changed? Has our population changed? And I will say what the research tells us and what we know as the population has shifted a bit. One, we're saving a lot more babies that are born early. Prematurity is a risk factor for autism. It doesn't mean if a child is born early, they'll have autism, but it's one of the stated potential risk factors. And it's a good thing, but it also creates a lot more need and medical complexity. And so that is one contributing factor. Also, as a society, people are having children later. That is another, again, it's not a guarantee, but it also can be another risk factor for autism. In fact, there was a research study that said advanced paternal age can increase chances of having a child with autism. And as we know, we are continuing to evolve as a field of understanding genetics and the complex interplay with environmental factors. And so really, I guess I will say it's not one single reason. There are many different factors as to why we are seeing these rates increase as they are.
That's so helpful and so interesting. And I do think that that is, and thank you for laying out that historical timeline, truly, because I honestly, when you said 2013, the DSM was updated, I mean, it just seems like 2 years ago when we know 2013 was not two years ago.
But it was 13 years ago. In fact, there's talks right now of the DSM-6, you know, and so what will that look like? And how will that change how we view autism, future trends in autism? And yeah, it was a big discussion in 2013, at least in the circles I run in as a psychologist. Sure. You know, how will it change? You know, how will it change how we view autism and the population of children with autism? You know, it'll be interesting to see what DSM-6 looks like.
Right. And you mentioned this too when you were sharing about the history and the historical timeline. It really, we have changed as a society. And I'll speak for the field of early childhood educators as well. Yes. There's a greater understanding of what autism means. And also kind of back, hearkening back to what you said in the opening was it's very individualized. And you know, one child with autism, you know, one child with autism. And I think that that's
absolutely,
that's become more of an understanding in the field of early care and education. And so how, when we think of childcare providers and the folks out there doing childcare every day, whether it's family childcare homes or center-based, how can they play a role in early identification?
Great question. And one thing I want to say, connecting early childcare providers and the numbers, when we look at numbers of 1 in 28 in Minnesota communities, childcare providers on here, daycare providers, it is highly likely you will have a child with autism in your classroom, in your daycare. They may or may not be identified yet. But when we look at those numbers, we know that it is much more common in communities. It is much more common in early childhood populations than it used to be. And so, yes, childcare providers play an important role. You have a front row seat to a child's development. Not to mention, you also have, you know, I'm a psychologist and we use sort of norm reference groups. That means comparison groups. And right there, childcare providers are experts in understanding what are the developmental milestones that are typical for a one-year-old, a two-year-old, a three-year-old. When should we expect first words? When should we expect reciprocal social interaction? So absolutely, childcare providers play an important role. So I would say, in talking with families and in your view of working with children, view it through the lens of development and what developmental milestones a child should be reaching. Communicate that to families regularly, both delays, but also the positive things. You know, I love to share this statistic. This is CDC data, but approximately one in four children, birth through five are at risk for a developmental delay. And people are always surprised by that. But when we consider the broad umbrella of developmental delays, including speech language delays, I think it makes sense. And so developmental delays are a normal part of child's, especially early childhood development. And as you said, Priscilla, children are developing individually within their own trajectory, but there are milestones that we do expect children to achieve within ranges of certain ages. And so childcare providers can play an important role in that. We also know from the data, the project, the ADAM project that we do, we really aren't getting to children early enough. As a clinical psychologist, I know that I can reliably and credibly diagnose autism anywhere between 18 months and 24 months with specialized training. But unfortunately, in Minnesota, we really aren't getting to kids with a clinical diagnosis of autism till about 4 years, 7 months. And again, I am preaching to the choir with this audience, but we know the time of birth through five is a time of tremendous growth and change, particularly in the brain, right? I mean, you cannot stop development if you wanted to. You watch a young child, they are like a sponge. It also makes it an optimal time for us to intervene and address developmental delays, delays in speech, delays in social interaction, delays in motor. So we really need childcare providers to use their expertise and knowledge to really help monitor child development and keep the lines of communication open with families, both about progress, but also if there are developmental concerns.
And I think one thing too is, and you mentioned, you know, with specialized training and all of these things, we're not saying run around and start diagnosing. And no. I know that that can be, especially if you have some experience working with a child and you might see some similar trends in a child's developmental path, but still what you're really advocating for, and it's something that we all need reminders of, we are in a partnership relationship with these families as they're navigating this road, and some for the very first time, if it's their first child.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And you know what? I think I'm so glad you brought that up, because we aren't asking childcare providers to diagnose. In fact, I think the best thing childcare providers can do is to have a partnership and an open dialogue with families about developmental progress. I don't think coming to a parent and saying, I think it's this.
Right.
But talking about it through the lens of development and observations that you see as a childcare provider. For example, you know, Bobby's doing a really great job with his motor skills. He's great out on the playground, but boy, his language, I'm just not seeing as much language as I typically see at this age. What are you seeing at home? You know, sort of that dialogue and that partnership, and talking about behavioral and developmental observations versus a diagnosis. I think that would be a tip that I would give. And then one thing I say is, the more you talk about development, again, both celebrating developmental achievements, but also when there are delays, the more it becomes a natural part of the conversation. You know, if you're doing things like, you know, parent-teacher conferences, or even just check-ins at pick-up and drop-off, that's a great thing to just sort of start the dialogue and start the conversation, because it's much easier if you've already started it to bring up concerns.
Yes.
If you've already built that relationship, that connection, and that sort of shared expectation that you're going to talk about development. For me, it's about progress and gains, and acknowledging that much more than it is about the diagnosis, even though I'm a psychologist, diagnosis,
right.
But in the context of childcare, I think that's the most important thing.
Absolutely. Oh, and so when you think about really what providers should be noticing, what are some things that they should be noticing and bringing forward to families in these conversations?
Absolutely. So a question I get asked, you know, what are some of the early signs of autism that you see during early childhood? And I think I'm going to share some, but I think it is really important for everyone, as I share, to think about this isn't one thing. It's a combination. What we say is a constellation of symptoms. So some examples that we look for when we're assessing, or that when we do an interview with parents, early signs of autism, one, not consistently responding to their name. Again, just because we see that doesn't mean a child has autism. I'll be honest, my teenagers that I have at home do not consistently respond when I say their name, is for different reasons. But that is one we see a lot in the population of children with autism in the early childhood years. Limited eye contact or social engagement. Lack of pretend play skills. Maybe the play, you know, it may be more rigid. Additional things, limited use of sort of those nonverbal communication skills, such as gestures, pointing. Again, not one of these means a child has autism, but we look at it all together. Certainly, we see language delays in this population. But that's a great example that a child can have a language delay, but it doesn't necessarily mean they have autism. A language delay is a general marker for a lot of different developmental delays. And so, and then as I think of things like behavioral rigidity, maybe narrow interests, maybe, you know, hyper-focus on something really, really small. You know, I've worked with kids across the age groups, but, you know, I've worked with young preschoolers. Maybe they're interested in elevators or the inner workings of an elevator or a vacuum cleaner. You know, it's a narrow interest that maybe isn't typical to other children their age. Motor movements such as hand flapping, rocking, a preference for playing alone. Again, we look at all of these together when we make a diagnosis, and we do a lot of direct observation as well as parent interview. Often we interview childcare providers, really to kind of, you know, triangulate or connect the dots of sort of how a child is functioning in their environment. I hope that is helpful. I can share a resource afterwards that has sort of a longer list.
That's great.
That would be helpful.
And we can include that and link it in the description of the podcast once it's live. And that's really helpful. And I think that that will be useful to our listeners. And I think, too, whenever folks are learning new information or learning about being better at their profession, they want strategies. Yeah. They want to know, how do I create an inclusive environment so that a child who may be diagnosed or may be on the road to a diagnosis, how can I include them in my setting in a really successful way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, what we know, first of all, you don't have to be an expert in autism to create an inclusive classroom. And we all know this. We create something that's more inclusive for one child, and it has this cascade effect that it's more accessible for everyone. And I know your audience is very good at that. I guess if I think of some sort of autism-specific strategies, though, that, again, will help all children in your classroom or all children in your daycare, one, having clear, predictable routines. I think that's not just specific to autism. We all thrive. Yeah. But it is particularly important for children with autism, you know, the predictability, the routine, the structure. Additionally, what we see from the research and best practices is a lot of children with autism are highly visual. So the more we can make an environment visual, you know, things like visual schedules, you know, we think of a preschool and having that up, you know, first we have morning meeting, then snack time, you know, maybe let them have a tactile component to that of moving that around the schedule. But the more we can make it predictable, routine, visual, that is very helpful.
Yeah.
Additionally, you know, ongoing communication with families about the child's needs. You know, many children with autism may have what we call, you know, atypical responses in terms of sensory.
Yes.
Maybe, you know, heightened sensory systems, things like noises, smells, bright lights may affect them more significantly than other children. And so accommodating around that. I mean, many of us, we don't like loud noises. We don't like sudden noises. You know, how can you accommodate for some of those sensory needs in the classroom? And again, so a lot of this is a dialogue with the family.
Right.
You may have to create more structured opportunities for peer interactions and social interactions and scaffold that, you know, in ways that you might not have to for other children that may come more naturally. And I know your audience is experts in this, but always see the child through the lens of strengths and holistically. You know, we aren't our diagnosis. It's a part of who we are. but also recognize all of the strengths and contributions that child brings and really approach it through a strengths-based approach. And families can help guide you in that as well.
Absolutely. Oh, well, that's really helpful. And we will link to other resources that we have a really nice tip sheet on play partnering. So how do you set kids up for success with partners that are a little, you know, that opportunity that behind the scenes, you're doing some orchestrating, but the children don't necessarily need to know all those details.
Absolutely.
But you're setting them up for success by creating partnership opportunities for successful practice.
I love it. I love it. And yeah, exactly. How do you create the structure? I don't mean standing over and hovering, but how do you integrate that to set children up for success for something that may be a challenge for them?
Yeah. And so now when we think about it, as we're kind of wrapping up our conversation, So when you think of and you know so much about public health research and autism surveillance and how does this all really matter to our communities? Why is it so important for us all to be partnering together?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. Because one thing, you know, I wanted to touch upon today, you know, for example, I wear many hats. I'm a clinician, but I'm also a researcher and each offer different and important things. And what I want to say is data is important. You know, our work on the ATOM projects, as I said earlier, it helps us understand really important trends. When I'm a clinician, I'm focusing on that child and family in front of me. When I am a public health researcher doing counting or autism surveillance, I am looking at what does autism look like in communities? Where is their need? Who are we identifying them? You know, when are we identifying them? Where, as I said earlier, our data tells us all of those things, and it tells us where we need to direct resources. You know, I want to say it is a smart public investment for us to understand the landscape of really any disability. You know, what are the needs? Where are the needs? Where do we need more resource? Maybe where do we need less? I don't know if we ever need less.
but
you know, so we can be smart about resource allocation and really how do we meet the needs of children and families in the best, smartest way possible. You know, one thing we know, and I love to share this statistic, not only is early intervention important for families, important for the child. We know that the outcomes across development, across a lifespan, are much more positive when we intervene early and give effective supports, particularly early on, but throughout the lifespan. There is also research that says, while it's hard for families at first, families ultimately, the earlier we identify, the sooner they get a support system and understanding and really a path forward for how to support their child. So we see significant benefits for the child, benefits for the family, which is very important. But we also know if we look at it through the lens of society and communities, there is research that tells us that effective early intervention can reduce lifetime costs of autism anywhere from 1/3 to 2/3, depending on what study. So the cost savings, not only does it help children and families, but the cost savings are significant across a lifespan when we get to kids early.
That's so important. And I think, you know, as we wrap up, that is a beautiful way to just really ignite a partnership across communities and across, you know, your neighborhoods or whatever. I think that really, truly, anyone who's spending time with young children and getting to spend that really special, precious time during those birth to 5 years, especially as our listeners do, it's so important for us to be in tune for many reasons, but to, you know, really connect with kids, listen to them, watch them, and really give them an opportunity to play. That's when we can have those chances to think about, oh, I'm noticing this. If we're always in there directing and planning, we're not going to get an opportunity to see what's really happening in some cases.
Absolutely.
Too. Yeah.
I mean, the early childhood years, I don't need to tell you, I don't need to tell your listeners, It is a magical time in terms of developmental transformations. Where I work, there's a lot of brain researchers that do brain imaging, and to watch the change in a child's brain, it is just an amazing and magical time. But yes, we need to give kids structures and supports, but also the space to develop and to learn and to grow. I absolutely agree with you on that.
Yeah. Oh, well, Dr. Jinhal Landy, thank you for being a part of our podcast. And, you know, anything that you just feel like, oh, wait, I forgot to say this, or did we cover everything that you wanted to touch on today?
Yeah, I think in closing, I'd love to say, you know, the data that we shared here matter because children and families matter. You know, and as I said in the beginning, every number, every piece of data that we collect represents a child, a family, a community, all of us working together to connect the data to the best possible services and supports for children and families. So thank you so much for this opportunity. I would love to come back and share more of our data. We have a lot of it, but I really appreciate the conversation today.
Oh, thank you so much. And you can certainly come back anytime. And I know we ran into each other at a meeting recently, and Jen was like, I have some things I want to share. And I mean, yes. It really is. That's how these podcasts happen. So it's truly an honor to be able to say that I know who you are and I know you, and because you are a wealth of information. And I'm also grateful that we have such a good partnership with the University of Minnesota and all of the work that's over there. So thank you, Jen, for being a part of our podcast. And for our listeners, we will definitely link any of the information that Jen shares with us. Also, you know where to find CDC, you know, connections, and so many resources and tools out there to help you as early educators. And we have some on our website. So we will make sure that all those are available in the description.
Absolutely. There is a wealth of information online. If you look at the CDC's Autism Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, just a wealth of data on autism across different states, as well as the CDC's Learn the Signs Act Early, has just an abundance of free materials that childcare providers can use to help track development. So I am happy to share.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Jen. And thank you to our listeners. And if you want more information, just go to our website, inclusivechildcare.org. We'll see you again on the next podcast.
For more information and a wide range of resources, visit inclusivechildcare.org. You'll find information on our coaching services and support on topics such as healthy child development, strategies for encouraging positive behavior, and guidance on including children with unique social, emotional, and learning needs, and much more.